Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast on behalf of the New Books Network. I'm Ben Goldfarb, your host. This month, we'll be speaking with John Waldman about his new book, Running Silver, Restoring Atlantic Rivers and Their Great Fish Migrations. In Running Silver, Waldman chronicles the tragic collapse of migratory fish, like sturgeon, salmon, and eels, in East Coast rivers, and describes how these species have faded in cultural importance. Yet he ends on a hopeful note, with a roadmap to recovering these fish and restoring our rivers. This is a book that remembers what we've lost, and explains how we can return migratory fish to our waters and our lives. So, without further ado, please welcome to our program John Waldman, author of Running Silver. John, I thought you might begin by telling us a little about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor of biology at Queens College currently, and I grew up in the Bronx in what I would sometimes call a huck-thin childhood in a Tom Sawyer world, living close to the water in the Bronx, which is not the place you think of when you think of marine biology. But I played on the shores of the Bronx and Pelham Bay Park and became smitten by the aquatic world. And for my schooling, I stayed local. I finished my PhD at the City University of New York in a program in conjunction with the Museum of Natural History, and was hired by the Hudson River Foundation for Science and Environmental Research to spend 20 years there. And while I was there, I saw New York Harbor sort of changing before my eyes and felt compelled to write a book, which was titled Heartbeats in the Muck. And Heartbeats in the Muck, I wasn't trained as a historian, but Heartbeats in the Muck was very history-oriented, looking at the trajectory of change in New York Harbor, which was tremendous in the environmental sense. And it got me fascinated with the whole world of historical ecology. And I had also always been fascinated by rivers. Even though I grew up in the Bronx near the saltwater, I spent a lot of time upstate on rivers. And I've been very concerned about the fate of our migratory fish, the fish that go between freshwater and saltwater. And there had been some treatments of what had happened to these fish at a single species level, like John McPhee's wonderful book, The Founding Fish, and James Prosek's book on eels. But I felt like there was a story to be told for the entire suite holistically. And so I dove into the historical ecology of these fish. And these fish are really rather amazing. These are called diatomous fish, just a little ichthyology 101. These are fish that are either born in salt water and go to fresh water or vice versa. The fish most people think of that do this are the anadromous fish, that are fish like salmon that spawn in a river and go to sea and then return. The opposite is catadromous, which are eels, which are born in the ocean and spend their lives in fresh water and then go back to salt water. So they only compose about less than 1% of the world's fishes, but some of them are among the most iconic species in the world, like salmon and sturgeon and shad and striped bass. And they have declined dramatically, for the most part, along the Atlantic coast. And this is what the story I told in Running Silver.
Yeah. So maybe you can paint us a picture of what these great fish migrations once looked like in terms of species and abundance before the arrival of Europeans to North America.
Yes, well, running silver is a term that was sometimes used for a river that suddenly looked silver with all the bodies of these bright fish that are emerging from the ocean and driving up river. You know, it was quite a spectacle. And there are other wonderful descriptions of people being blown away by the sheer abundance. Another term you sometimes see is the idea that people could walk dry shod across their backs because they were so thick you wouldn't get your feet wet. And of course, that's embellished, but it was, you know, echo of a reality. And in the book, I collected some of these wonderful quotes, and there's one quote I just want to read briefly that is my absolute favorite that just gives you a sense of the reaction of colonists to what they saw. This was by William Byrd in the 1700s, and he was writing about the alewives. It's like a very small shad. And he wrote, "When they spawn, all streams and waters are completely filled with them, and one might believe, when he sees such terrible amounts of them, that there was as great a supply of herring as there is water. In a word, it is unbelievable, indeed indescribable, as also incomprehensible, what quantities found there. One must behold oneself." And I describe that as a festival of superlatives. But this was not totally out of the ordinary for that time period, because you have to realize that these were people of European origin that were coming from a continent that had been heavily fished for hundreds and hundreds of years and had major habitat change and pollution, and they were no longer accustomed to almost pristine abundances. You know, we had Native Americans, of course, who were certainly fishing these species, but they existed in low numbers, these populations, and they had not been driven down yet. So the European colonists were simply blown away by what they saw. And it was funny how unprepared the Europeans were. You know, the Native Americans made use of these fish. They caught them in myriad ways, from spearing with lights at night on canoes and all kinds of elaborate weirs and nets and hooks made from bone. And they even used eel grease in their hair to sort of smooth it out. The colonists came here really unprepared for fishing. They brought no fishing gear with them. And Captain John Smith has a passage where he writes about these hungry colonists going out and trying to catch fish in Chesapeake Bay with frying pans. And he admits in the end that frying pans are not a very good fishing device.
who would have guessed? So, you know, one of the things that you're highlighting now is the fact that most people are probably familiar with, you know, the big ticket species like salmon and sturgeon and striped bass, as you say. But one of the great things about your book is that it shines a light on the importance of eels and, you know, another less heralded species like sea lampreys, you know, which are now maligned by many anglers. You know, I was wondering if you could talk about some of the less renowned species like lampreys. But what is a lamprey exactly, and what makes it worthy of attention in your book?
You know, lampreys are really a fascinating fish. They're extremely primitive, you know, in the evolutionary line of fish. They don't have any bone, and they don't really have jaws. What they have is a sucking disc, and they're parasites. They will attach themselves to other fish and then suck out bodily fluids and often kill the host fish. And they migrate in the spring up rivers, and unlike most of these anadromous fish, they don't home. They don't come back to the river they were spawned in. They simply use the next or most adjacent suitable river, because when they go out to sea, they don't maintain a coherent circuit of migration. They go on one host and then another, and any single population is dragged all over the ocean. So they're really different from other anadromous fish in this lack of homing. But they're reviled in the Great Lakes because they invaded the Great Lakes, at least the four upper Great Lakes, in recent historical times, and decimated lake trout populations. And there's been war against them in the Great Lakes and Lake Champlain ever since. So in the Great Lakes, they're public enemy number one. Along the East Coast, their numbers declined, but they were never really very popular here. So they just as a food, and never really reviled either because they weren't that numerous. So they just kind of existed, you know, under the radar screen. And then in Europe, they've been consumed and treated as a delicacy for a very long time. So it's interesting that one species can have three such different perceptions concerning them. They also are remarkable in that they have one of the greatest altitudinal ranges on Earth. They will sometimes swim into headwaters of the Great Lakes and being hundreds and hundreds of feet above sea level, but they also occur in the deep ocean. And I'm not sure there's any species on the planet that has a greater range in elevation. So they are an interesting species. Right. And they're one of several other species that don't get a lot of respect. You know, as I said, the salmon and shad and sturgeon are iconic, but we have things like alewives and blueback herring that look like small shad that are not as famous, but they are major, major bait fish species. And there's a lot of concern these days about the balance, the ecological balance in the oceans, and whether we are fishing down our prey species too much. And because these runs of these alewives and blueback herring have diminished so much, they may be hurting the balance in the open ocean. So they may not be the greatest food fishes or sport fishes, but they play a major ecological role.
Hmm. So what about the shad? I mean, I feel like, you know, of course they are iconic. They have been written about. McPhee called them the founding fish, but they're so important here. It seems like we have to mention the shad. I mean, maybe you could describe, you know, these early shad runs and talk about their importance both to native people and to the Europeans when they did arrive.
Shad are, to me, the exemplary East Coast anadromous species because they really dominated, rivers in the spring. They're large. They reach up to 10 or 12 pounds, and they came in absolutely extraordinary numbers. They also were very predictable. People knew what time they would show up in rivers, and this is one of the great values of anadromous fish is that, you know, if you were looking for these fish in the open ocean, you could never find them. But based on experience, you know that in any given river, around a certain date, they're just going to come marching up towards your nets. And that provides a great opportunity for sustenance, but it also provides great vulnerability to the fish. So shad were often viewed as a great symbol of spring to the colonists, and they would have shad festivals up and down the coast, and there was great excitement about the first shad roe, their eggs, which are considered a delicacy, reaching major markets like New York and Philadelphia. And even along the Hudson here, I've been to a shad bake where they use the traditional method of taking shad fillets, which require boning, and boning is a lost art because shad have incredible numbers of bones, and only a few people know how to do this anymore. But you take these bone fillets and you nail them with bacon strips to oak boards, and then hold them against a fire and roast them slowly. And their Latin name, Olosus Appetissima, means most delicious of herrings, and they actually are a fabulous food source. So they are delicious. So shad have played a major role in the history of fisheries on the East Coast. They were a tremendous food source for the early colonists, and they have gone down dramatically. In the case of the Hudson, In 1889, we had peak landings of 4 million pounds. These are 4 million pounds harvested from the river. You know, who knows how much was left behind. Over the last several years, the runs have become so small that there is absolutely no harvest allowed at all, either recreationally or commercially. And there are few signs that they're actually recovering at all. So this is not that atypical for rivers along the East Coast. There are other rivers, too, that have had incredible declines in the order of 95 or 98% from peak runs.
Right. So in the Hudson, clearly the problem was overfishing. But on most rivers, it sounded like the real issue was the dams that started popping up, you know, as Europeans settled and the population increased. I mean, what explained the sort of the explosion of dam construction? Why did these dams seem like a good idea, you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries?
Well, for the early colonists, the dams were the alternative source of power from animal power. You know, there was no electricity. So in order to grind wheat and other grains, many, many mill dams were built on smaller streams and creeks along the East Coast. And that blocked a lot of the connectivity, you know, among these systems. And then later on, as the Industrial Revolution geared up, there was a need for power to drive the mills. And that's when we saw more and more mainstem dams being built. And the mainstem dams are worse than the mill dams because the mill dams were often on the little tributaries, but the mainstem dams would block the movements of these fish often very early on as they entered the rivers. So we have these tremendous blockages that in some cases allowed some spawning below the dams, and in some cases prohibited any spawning below the dams, and this just annihilated many species that needed to get upriver.
Right.
And dams were only one of the perturbations. For a long time there was sort of a mantra about why these fish declined. It was dams, overfishing, and pollution, in that order. And overfishing is probably relatively easily reversed just through regulatory changes. And species can rebound quickly. And this happened with striped bass. Striped bass crashed in the Chesapeake Bay in the 1980s, and a drastic reduction in fishing allowed them to come back. Pollution is not as bad as it might seem, because many fish can tolerate pollution. What they can't tolerate is low oxygen levels. So in situations where you had human sewage overwhelming a system, driving oxygen low, you often had a loss of these runs. But just pure chemical contamination was not that big an issue, in my opinion. But since the days of the mantra of the big three, I think there's increasing recognition that non-native species are playing a role. You know, one of the reasons why we think these fish make these costly migrations, where they have to swim hundreds of miles from oceans up into rivers against the current and make osmotic changes from salt water to fresh water within their bodies, is that headwaters are good places to leave eggs and young, because there's few predators there. And in fact, we've introduced so many non-native species along the Atlantic coast, so that, you know, the Hudson, which only had a few predatory species early on, now has largemouth bass and smallmouth bass and various pikes and pickerels that weren't there, and many other species. I think this is a kind of an unseen factor that is probably more prominent than we think. Then there are things like power plants, which suck up water for cooling their systems and often entrain or impinge literally hundreds of millions of eggs and larvae. And climate change is also now a recently noted factor. We're seeing changes in the distributions of some fish. Smelt, which is a delicious little anadromous fish, used to run as far south as Delaware River. They ran into the Hudson until about the year 2000, but they disappeared from there. And now they disappeared from Connecticut and are retreating northward to Massachusetts. So we're seeing species range shifts, and we're also seeing changes in the timing. You know, we know from experience when fish typically enter rivers, and they're entering many rivers now earlier and earlier, and then they have unseen ramifications for the ecology of those systems and how the young then survive within the rivers because the timing is now drastically changed. So these fish face quite a few challenges.
Yeah, just going back to the non-native species issue for one second, you know, one of the invasives that you mention in the book is zebra mussels in the Hudson. What's the story there exactly? Because I know there have been some changes in the story too over time.
Yeah, zebra mussels entered the Hudson in the 1990s, and zebra mussels are native to Europe and Asia, and they were taken by accident in ballast water ships that released their larvae in the Great Lakes. And since then, they spread over much of the U.S., and they came to the Hudson and exploded. And one year, there were none there, and next year, there were 550 billion, as an estimate. Wow. And they filtered the water column of the river once a day and reduced phytoplankton by as much as 85% in the beginning, which had, of course, you know, this was a big monkey wrench in the ecology of the system. And it was shown very nicely that it affected the relative abundances of the fish community, so that the zebra mussels made the water clearer, which made the weed beds expand, which then favored the weed bed species like sunfish and largemouth bass, but it hurt the species that live in the open water column as larvae like shad and striped bass. So this changed the ecology of the river, and these things are here to stay. There has been a change over time. It seems like the mussels are not doing as well, and it may be that when they first enter a system, the species that encounter them are naive to them and haven't or don't have the ability to immediately build them into their life cycle. But since then, species like short-nosed sturgeon and freshwater drum and various sunfish and ducks have been found to be eating these mussels more and more. Hmm. And it may be that we're reaching more of a balance, but there's no doubt that they change the system dramatically and probably hurt our anadromous fish species.
Right. There are a few stories you tell in the book that to me are really illustrative of the challenges of protecting and restoring these species. And I wonder if you could talk briefly about what's going on with American eels today, because the eel seems like a great illustration of how the challenges of regulating fisheries have changed and how the regulations themselves have failed to catch up. So what's happening with American eels?
There's no doubt that eels have really, really declined dramatically along the East Coast. Our eel population is different from our anadromous fish populations because the anadromous fish populations, for the most part, are individual to each river. So the Hudson has its own shad population, the Savannah River has its own striped bass population, and so on. Eels are born in the Sargasso Sea out in the open ocean and drift as larvae with the Gulf Stream and then sort of just break off the Gulf Stream and enter rivers. So there is no, you know, Kennebec River or Connecticut River population. They're all part of the same general mix of this Atlantic Ocean population. So when they decline in one place, they decline everywhere because they're all getting sort of a random distribution from this large single ocean population. And numbers are declining everywhere. Partly because dams have blocked their access to freshwater habitat, partly because of overfishing of the adults or the sub-adults for bait, and potentially for climate change factors in the open ocean. But one fishery that's interesting right now is that there's a fishery for the little elvers, the baby, what they call glass eels that haven't transformed to dark eels yet. That's open in Maine and a little bit in South Carolina. And the Maine fishery is a little bit, in my opinion, out of control. The people are spending day and night fishing for these things and getting hundreds and hundreds of dollars per pound. And it's not. And the reason why they cost so much is that there's demand for them in Asian countries, particularly Japan. And they're able to get prices that are just extraordinary. And it's probably hurting the overall population, even though it's being fished in Maine. This is a single population, and it's quite controversial.
Yeah. So to sum it all up, we've got overfishing, we've got dams, we've got fish getting trapped in power plant cooling systems, invasive species, climate change. Obviously, the deck is really stacked against diadromous fish, and I'm wondering if you can sort of encapsulate just how much the runs have changed, I guess, in the last 500 years. How dramatically, have they been reduced? How much have we lost?
Well, again, I did an analysis with a colleague where we found that looking at the best data we could find for the North Atlantic, both Europe and North America, that many populations had declined 95 to 98% from their peaks. Wow. Which is a tremendous drop. But just to give you more examples, I mentioned the shad example in the Hudson. The Susquehanna River was the major shad river on the East Coast. It was like a shad Shangri-La. And when the colonists first came here, shad used to migrate through Chesapeake Bay, up the Susquehanna, all the way to the center of New York State at Otsego Lake. And it's about a 500-mile trip within the river. And John Fenimore Cooper wrote about these vast shoals of this herring-like fish that entered Otsego Lake, and it actually helped save starving colonists in that region early on. So this was in a river that just had innumerable numbers of shad coming in. And over time, and when the fisheries were going strong, the schools of shad were so large they sometimes produced a bow wave in front of them. People could see the water changing as the body of fish moved up. And there was one haul that's famous where they set this big net in the lower river, and the wind changed, and they couldn't get it in for a while. And then it filled with so many fish that it took 3.5 days to land it. Wow. And it was an estimated 15 million shad and river herring taken in that one haul. It just took forever to get those fish out of the net. 15 million estimate for that one single haul. Later on, they built the Conowingo Dam at the mouth of the river. It's just 10 miles from the actual mouth. So the next 490 miles of river is now shut off from shad until they built a fishway to allow them to pass. But the fishway hasn't worked well. So the numbers have now declined to the point where the total run sizes are every year on the order of hundreds to a few thousand from a system that produced 15 million in one hole.
Mm. So
another example is the there's one more that's worth mentioning, I think, and that's the Delaware River. In the late 1800s, there was an international caviar craze, you know, kind of almost like the tulip craze in Holland. There was just worldwide excitement about caviar, and anywhere you could find sturgeon efficiently, they were fished and overfished. And the Delaware River was the preeminent sturgeon river along the Atlantic coast. And in 1888, there were 6 million pounds of sturgeon pulled out of the Delaware River alone. And this went on for about a decade to the point where in the 1900s, you could not find a single sturgeon, and Atlantic sturgeon, that is. And it's only just recently that we are seeing any signs of a few fish spawning there. So this fishery was so important to that region that one of the towns was named Caviar. And when the fish disappeared, they renamed it as Bayside. I think they were embarrassed.
So how has the public reacted to the virtual disappearance of, you know, what used to be one of our greatest resources? What has the outcry been over the last 100 years?
Yeah, I think that the average citizen is not aware of what happened. I think there are people who were either serious anglers or conservationists who are aware and feel saddened by it, but feel like there's not that much that can be done. One of the themes of the book was that I followed Thoreau's observations. Thoreau was, you know, an incredibly prescient and perceptive observer, and he had paddled the Concord and Merrimack rivers with his brother during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and published a book about it, you know, a week on the Concord and Merrimack rivers. And in it, he has many sad but right on predictions about what will happen to these fish in the face of industrialization. And it's just interesting that he could see all this coming, and yet nowadays, looking back retrospectively, we barely notice that it happened. And this brings up the subject of, or the new concept of shifting baselines, which is a term you often now see in conservation biology, in which basically says that resource managers don't really attempt to bring back populations to where they were. They try to hold the line to what they see, and typically it slips. And each generation, there's more and more of the slipping, almost like a ratchet. And over time, we lose track of what was there because we're seeing what we see within each generation, and the diminution that occurs to the next one. And there's just very little recognition of true abundances that go back far in time. And this is one of the driving forces for this new field of historical ecology that attempts to go back in time and just refresh our memories of what's been lost. And the problem with this whole field is that quite often the information is not quantitative. And we live in a world now where science is typically done quantitatively. But the person who proposed this shifting baselines theory, Daniel Pauly, mentioned an account he had heard from a relative of his about the abundance of tuna in some location. And he said this is as factual as you know, more recent fisheries data. It's just not quantitative.
Right.
So we go back to historical records, to diaries of early fishermen, to archaeological remains, and so on. And what we're finding is that, you know, we lived in a world that was very different from what we see today. And it's kind of sad. And I think one of the things that we've lost with our loss of these fish runs is a sense of spectacle. You know, I think, you know, when I'm out with my children and we see 100 starlings fly by, we say, wow, a lot of birds. But, you know, we had passenger pigeons in the 1800s that flew in flocks that passed overhead like a atmospheric river for hours on end.
Right.
And then we had movements of these fish into rivers that were, you know, so awe-inspiring. We said the river ran silver. You know, we don't have access to the sort of spiritual renewal we would get from those kinds of spectacles anymore. And I think that's actually a rather sad thing.
Yeah. So shifting baselines is akin, or it's a predecessor to a wonderful term that you coined and refer to in this book, which is eco-social enemy. And I wonder what does that term mean? Maybe you can explain what you meant by eco-social enemy.
Well, I think that the shifting baselines paradigm is quite real, but the way it was defined, it was really connected to resource managers. And there's another term that I think applies more to the public, and that's the term of intergenerational amnesia, where the public basically loses the knowledge that their grandfathers, you know, used to eat shad routinely and that it was a big part of their lives, or whatever species we're talking about. So my colleague Karen Lindbergh and I came up with this term that tried to unite those two, the sense that there's sort of a reciprocal spiral effect where the public loses track of what it lost, doesn't care as much, doesn't put as much resources into it. The resource manager tries to hold the line but doesn't have the resources. It slides further. The public then, you know, loses more connection. And over time, you just have this spiral down to what brings us to another term that I like, which is out there in conservation biology. It's the notion of ghost species, The idea that there are species that have left holes in our ecology. And, you know, one example of that is the speed of the pronghorn antelope. You know, the pronghorn antelope is an incredibly fast runner out on the open plains of the U.S., but it has no need to be so fast anymore because it has no predators like that. But in earlier times, in the Pleistocene, there were you know, fierce lions and other species that could chase these antelopes, and so that, you know, they have this residue of this ability that's based on species that are essentially ghosts. And I think that we have many species now that function as ghosts, in that they're so scarce that they no longer play an ecological role of any meaning, or that they absolutely are gone. And in that case, they're, you know, a true ghost.
Hmm. So how do we go about reversing these forces? How do we correct intergenerational amnesia? How do we unshift our baselines? How do we make people care about fish that, you know, if we're being honest, are no longer relevant to most people's lives?
Well, I think the only hope is to make them aware again, and that's, again, what historical ecology attempts to do. And a lot of this information ends up in journal articles, but I think there's a need for scientists and writers to take this to the general public and say, hey, guys, this was pretty amazing. It's gone, but it could be reversed with some effort, and we should at least try. So this was the reason why I wrote this book. I felt like there was a story to be told here, but I also felt like I really wanted to help re-inspire people to care more about this. So I think getting the public behind this is the key initial task, and then there's a question of which tactics do you use. And one of the things that I propose in the end of my book, the last chapter focuses on 10 ideas for the future, and the one that I feel is most important that I would like to see become something of a national movement is the idea that every dam should have an existential crisis. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we have 80 to 100,000 dams over 6 feet in the U.S. alone, and who knows how many smaller ones. And many, many, many of them just exist through inertia. You know, you can't take a dam and go puff and blow it away in a minute. You have to, you know, when I say they exist through inertia, they're not being used by industry anymore. They're just there because they are a big mass of concrete or earth or a combination, and it's no simple task to get rid of them. So you have to get the people who own the dam or the public behind, who has property on the ponds behind the dam, behind it. You have to find funding. You have to work with resource agencies to do this in a way that's not ecologically harmful. You know, it's no simple task. But I think that it's being done rather piecemeal now. You know, there are states that are really great leaders in this effort. I think along the East Coast, the standouts are Maine, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. And they don't seem to leave any opportunities ignored these days. Other states are doing very little. And it is kind of piecemeal. Sometimes it's grassroots-led, sometimes it's agency-led. But I would like to see there be just sort of a national scorecard for each dam where the pros and cons of having that dam continue to persist in the, you know, in the echo of the Industrial Revolution are challenged. And many dams, of course, will be shown to still serve some useful purpose, but many, many of them also don't do so and cause what I consider sort of ecological havoc or harm and should be challenged.
How effective are dam removals? How quickly do they pay dividends in terms of restoring fish?
Usually very quickly. The really major effort on the East Coast was the removal of the Edwards Dam near Augusta, Maine, on the Kennebec in 1999.
Right.
And when that happened, immediately salmon, sturgeon, shad, striped bass were seen to be going further upriver, and there's signs of recovery in most of those species, and also it provided access to a major tributary, the Sebasticook, which was then recolonized by alewives, and that run went from 0 to 2 million very quickly. So the evidence is that dam removals usually provide immediate and tangible benefits, sometimes very large benefits. It's not the only thing that could be done. One thing that has been done concerning dams, which has been, in my mind, rather a halfway measure, is the installation of fishways. And fishways can either be fish ladders that are essentially chutes with baffles that slow the water down that will allow species to pass a dam by working their way through these chambers, or fish elevators, which are these devices that essentially draw fish into them at the face of a dam and then right up the face of the dam, and they hit the right floor and get off and swim into the reservoir. These sometimes work somewhat effectively. They're very species selective. There are species like sturgeon and striped bass that would never use the fish ladder. There are species like shad where it sometimes works decently, and there are species like alewives which are pre-adapted to leaping up little streams that like fish ladders and use them pretty openly. So it's kind of been a mixed bag. When you put a fishway on a dam, you think you've solved the problem, or at least the public does, but in reality, it is only a halfway measure. It's not nearly as effective as actually removing a dam.
Right. I really liked your idea, the dam existential crisis, the cost-benefit scorecard. I'm wondering, if you were appointed fisheries czar and given the power to remove a single dam on the East Coast, which one would you take out and why?
Well, the one that breaks my heart is the Conowingo Dam on the Susquehanna. Now, taking out the Conowingo would not be an easy thing, nor would it be totally effective in isolation, because there are three more dams that occur in rapid succession behind it. So in order to really open that system, you'd want to take all four down. But the Conowingo, as I said, it stops migration effectively 10 miles into a system where they used to penetrate 500 miles. And the fish ladders and fish elevators in that system have not worked very well to date. So I would love to open up those dams. There's a real paradox there, though, in that Chesapeake Bay is terribly eutrophic, and a lot of that is coming from sediments washed from the watershed in Susquehanna, and these dams have served to trap a lot of that sediment. And it's not clear that if you took those dams down, you wouldn't have a big problem in the estuary with nutrient release. On the other hand, these dams are filling up with these sediments very quickly. Every second, something like 100 pounds of sediment comes into Chesapeake Bay from the Susquehanna. So, and that's just what's not trapped behind those dams. So there's a problem with these dams filling up with sediment. And one of the untold stories about dams in the U.S. is that a lot of our dams are aging and are going to require replacement or repair at some point. You know, they occasionally break and cause damage. And, you know, in a country that's not doing a great job on infrastructure repair, we're seeing a scary situation evolve with dams in this country. So that's one more reason to take dams down where not required.
Hmm. So in the case of the Conowingo Dam, where you have this big buildup of sediment, how do you address that? Can you take it out one piece at a time, or dredge it first, or what do you do about that?
Yeah, they are trying to see if they can dredge it. It's going to be very expensive, and one initial attempt did not work well. It quickly filled in again. It's been looked at as sort of almost a time bomb in terms of the Chesapeake Bay, because these reservoirs will fill eventually, and when they do, they'll no longer act as reservoirs for water, and they're going to allow the rest of the sediments that come in to pass directly into the bay. So it's a very unfortunate situation. And, ideally, I'd love to see it go back to its original state where there are no dams there and the sediments washed out freely. But that would be a major paradigm change in how we manage that part of the country.
Right. So the final chapter of your book is entitled Toward a New Stewardship. And you mentioned that you had 10 rules or guidelines toward restoring rivers. And one of which is the damn existential crisis. And I was wondering if you could just briefly touch upon some of the other really important guidelines you lay out for restoring rivers and fish.
Well, a few of them are for one thing, the FERC, or the Federal Regulatory Energy Regulatory Commission, licenses fish ladders and fish ways, and they kind of freeze them in time over decades because the utility companies don't want any surprises, and it makes it very hard to adjust these fish ladders. These fish ways are almost a black art in getting them to work right, and I'd like to see more flexibility in just continuing to adjust them to get them to work as well as they can, even though I'd rather see the dam come down. Another one is to use more alternative sources of hydroelectric power. You know, there's a lot of water that's moved from place to place in tunnels that could be used to draw power from. And none of them are going to be, you know, the Hoover Dam in terms of output. But I think the future for energy production in this country is more small sources. And I think we could be looking more at capturing water that's being used for human purposes to produce power. I'd also like to see some rivers chosen to be what I consider ecological touchstone rivers as points of reference for the rest of our rivers. You know, we anoint rivers as heritage rivers based on their history, but I'd like to see almost the equivalent of marine protected areas for rivers where two or three of them are kind of left as wild as possible so that we have a basis for comparison and also the protection that occurs from having those populations left alone. I think there's a need to recomplexify rivers. One of the things I've seen in looking through the history of these fish resources is that often a single population would have life history variants within a single population. In other words, you might have shad that came into a river that looked a little different, you know, early in the spring and spawned somewhere else than the shad that came in later that looked a little different and had another location but spawning within the river. And by having multiple life history variants in a system, you buffer against the system not being productive in any single year. And because we now force these fish often to just spawn in one location under a dam or above a dam, we've lost that life history variation that produces that draws more production out of any single system. So I'd like to see not only systems opened up, but also more complexified in the way that rivers used to look. There's very good evidence now that our notion of what a river looks like is not what it should be, and that, you know, we think rivers are sort of single deep channels naturally, but there's evidence now that originally our rivers were much wider, shallower, and braided with all kinds of little islands and sandbars and snags of wood, and that, you know, we had species that were adapted to those conditions that we may be forcing them to now live in other conditions. And one more point I want to make is that I think we need to get kids wet and educated. I think that getting kids out into the local rivers is incredibly important. Every time I've taken kids out, school kids, seining for fish, you know, just netting fish, wearing waders and pulling a net in the shallows, their eyes just light up. And, you know, the idea of the ecology of river goes from a, you know, textbook notion to a real notion, and they get all excited. And when you get kids excited, you also automatically get their parents excited. So you're able to actually draw interest from two generations at once. In conjunction with that, I would have school kids study their own local rivers and create kind of historical ecology analyses of what those rivers used to look like so that they themselves get a sense of what's been lost. I think that would be a great, you know, sort of annual task for school kids who live near rivers of any size.
Yeah, I know that for me, going out on the Clearwater Sloop on the Hudson was a hugely formative experience in terms of, you know, seeing what was out there and, you know, experiencing the local ecology a little bit. Great. So
exactly. You can't have too many of those kinds of programs.
Yeah. All right. So John, final question. You know, like most fish scientists, you are yourself a fisherman. I would love to hear your best fish story.
Well, I have one that's sort of embarrassing, but I'll tell it because and it involves a river, but not natural fish. And I'm a fly fisherman among my other kinds of angling pursuits. And one day I was trout fishing on the Amawalk River in New York, and it was a very warm, kind of slow day. I wasn't catching anything. And I came to this section of river where it bumped up against a suburban street. And there was a little slack water area there, and I saw some sunfish there. And I just thought, well, just to have some action and fun, I cast my fly into the sunfish. And I caught one right away. And I realized that there was a gigantic dog standing behind me. and I decided, for no reason that I could justify now, to swing the fish over to the dog while it was still hooked on my line to see if he would sniff it and if he'd show any interest. Well, the giant dog, without hesitating, swallowed the fish while it was hooked on my line. And I instinctively pulled back because I wanted to get it away from the dog. Well, the hook came out of the fish's mouth and snagged the dog in the lip.
Oh, so gosh.
Here I was wearing my waders on the suburban street, hooked to a giant dog. And I thought, okay, this dog could eat me in 3 bites. I am just going to cut the line and let the owner deal with this little tiny fly. The dog was showing no distress, so I felt okay about doing that. And I just sort of slinked away. But I wrote about it in an article I wrote for the New York Times years later. And it actually got me installed into a book called The Fishing Hall of Shame, not Hall of Fame. So I it's a dubious distinction, but I am in the Fishing Hall of Shame because of this experience.
Well, the dog is probably okay. It's the most important
thing. I think so. It was just pricked, but I wasn't about to tangle with it.
Yeah, that sounds like a good decision. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for helping to correct our intergenerational amnesia. And it's been a really enlightening conversation about a wonderful book.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Okay, that's our show for this month. I'm Ben Goldfarb on behalf of New Books in Environmental Studies and the New Books Network. Thanks again to John Waldman, author of Running Silver, for taking time to speak with us. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. See you next month.